Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast, episode 476. What do they do next? Part 20A, Rick Wakeman, once again.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 476 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in a little bit. Do please get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week we return to our occasional What Did They Do Next series, and it's Rick Wakeman's turn once again. After some fairly typical personal and legal upset, the band and Rick parted ways, and there was to be no repeat of the Keys to Ascension positivity. At least not at this stage. This left Wakeman free to indulge other passions, and so he ramped up one of his long-held ambitions to return to the centre of the earth. Mark and I discuss this project a little later on, and then next week we will report back on the music itself. Around the social webs this week, and starting with the YMP Facebook page, Miguel Falcao announced Play for Chris 7. After last year's epic reworking of The Fish, I wonder what we'll have the chance to get involved with this time. Preston Frazier turned his second attention to Something's Coming as a bonus track on the first Yes album, and Dave Fagan, Alan White, and many others wished Steve Howe a happy birthday. In the community posts, Oscar Barrow added the Yes Stories band socially distanced roundabout cover, which is great, and Joseph Cottrell has received his copy of the Cherry Red Records Elias of Sun Hillow package, which looks amazing. Moving on to Jeffrey Mason's Hall, we have this week Rick Wakeman's latest video news update where he mentions a new box set of Return to the Centre of the Earth, which is exactly what this episode is about, so that's a real coincidence. An article about Steve Howe's Gibson ES-175 guitar. A 1977 review of Rick's White Rock. A 1975 review of Rick's The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table as an ice show at the Wembley Empire Pool. A happy birthday message to Steve Howe. An archived webpage detailing the 1996 release of Keys to Ascension. A 1975 review of the Relayer Tour. A March 2021 article, quite new then, about John Anderson from the Sunday Express newspaper. A photo from 1975 from Rick's Journey to the Centre of the Earth, again. Shine, which was a 1986 single collaboration from John Anderson and Mike Oldfield, one of my favourite songs. A recent interview with John Anderson himself and Steve Howe unplugged at Montreux Jazz Festival in 1979. Doug Curran added another happy birthday message to Steve Howe. The news that a special edition of Elias' Sun Hillow will be available in limited amounts for Record Store Day in July. His new double white vinyl copy of Halcyon Days, the brilliant album from the Downs Braid Association, and his 1972 New Age of Atlantic record, featuring Yes and lots of others. Stephen Lamb pointed us towards his recent birthday chat with Old Grey Whistle Test, or perhaps it was called just Whistle Test at that point, presenters David Hepworth and Mark Ellen. And via email, there was news of Olive Wakeman and Clive Nolan's lyric video for Coming to Town from Jabberwocky. I also wanted to mention this week that Greg Clinton left a comment on the site as follows. He says, I'm a long-time listener to the Yes Music Podcast. Many thanks to both you and Mark and all the other contributors for your information and entertaining work over the years. Thank you very much. My brother Larry and I have a little Yes novelty that's completely unique to share with you and the podcast audience. There was apparently an official Atlantic printing of the Close to the Edge album on cassette in the 1980s that contains an extra bar of music in Siberian Katru. It doesn't seem to be merely a mechanical or technical error in the dub. It's a repeat of 1/4-4 measure that's been edited seamlessly into the recording, with an extra crash cymbal hit exactly 6.5 minutes into the song. A few years ago, Larry alerted me that his cassette of Close to the Edge contained this anomaly. We both considered it quite remarkable and baffling, but we've never shared it with others. This year it occurred to me again that the two of you and the Yes Music Podcast audience may not have come across this before. Larry ordered his cassette by mail from Columbia Music Club sometime in the 1980s, and it's still in his possession. So now we have an MP3 transfer recording from the cassette, as well as a scan of the cassette cover insert that includes the Atlantic logo, a catalogue number, 19133, barcode, etc. The reverse side of the paper insert is blank. So we hope you find this interesting, and perhaps we might hear from others out there who happen to purchase the same printing of Close to the Edge on cassette. Incidentally, we, and our sister and friends, first saw Yes in concert on November the 14th, 1972, in Athens, Georgia, and that's the one that's included in the Seven Shows from 72 box set. So our voices are part of those crowd noises on the CD. We'd already been performing instrumental passages from Fragile in our fledgling high school age band before then, and have been hooked on Yes music ever since. He says, thanks again for your dedication and endless hours of work, shining a bright light on the deep and varied fountain of remarkable rock music that is Yes. From Greg Clinton. So thanks very much indeed, Greg. He posted a photo of that fascinating item on the website, so do go and have a look at that in the welcome post on the front page. And also do get in touch if you know more about this anomaly. And many thanks, as I say, to Greg. And also, as always, many thanks to everyone who got in touch in any way this week. Mark is with me now, all the way over there in Canada. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
Great. I mean, we're having a 20 degrees Celsius day here today. I couldn't be any happier because I've just completed my Dark Monarchy recording. It's time to mix in a couple of days. And I'm almost done my remix of An Ordinary Day, which is coming out for Record Store Day in July. Things couldn't have been better today.
Excellent. Well, you'll be in good company there for Record Store Day, because I know they're doing a limited edition version, 180-gram vinyl version of Elias of Sun Hillow, so in very good company with that.
Yes.
Anyway, not while we're here today. We're here today to talk about What Did They Do Next? And this is part 20A, so this is the 20th personnel change, and we're certainly not at the end yet. So once again, it's Rick Wakeman who left. Now, we're not going to go and rehash all the thing we've just been talking about, because we've just been talking about Keys to Ascension and what happened and what could have happened had Rick Wakeman stayed after that was all finished. But after he went away from that version of the band, he did some other things in terms of re-releases and so on. But the next thing that he did, which was really important and really new and new music and so on, was Return to the Center of the Earth, which is, as the name suggests, a sequel to his original Journey to the Center of the Earth, which I think was it 1976 or something like that?
74.
74. Okay, so right in the middle of all the Yes stuff as well, of course, and the change to Patrick Mraz and all those sorts of things that were going on at the time, he did this amazing record, another of his enormous epics. So what can you tell us, Mark, you're the expert on Rick Wakeman, about the original album that we're going to talk about the sequel of today?
Well, I mean, the original album, I mean, it's a classic. I mean, it's another one of those records that made, you know, the record label scratch their head and go, I can't believe this guy is selling like upwards of over 15 million copies of this thing. Who are buying these albums? You know, because I mean, they had the same reaction when Six Wives came out. And then, you know, this happened, and the next couple of albums were the same thing until they, you know, I think they got to King Arthur and they had that emergency meeting about sales because they were only hitting 10 million at that point. So that was cause for concern. But anyways, this record is very interesting. It was recorded live, mainly because he didn't have the funds available to do a proper studio recording version of this, because the studio that they would need would be a pretty immense one. There was a huge orchestra. So it was recorded live. And Rick was never completely happy with it, because, you know, he says that he can hear little errors and mistakes, you know, and there's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of crazy stories around the making of this record too. I mean, I'm not sure if he said this as a joke. With Rick, it's hard to tell sometimes, but he even said at the 11th hour that there's somebody tripped over an extension cord and popped out the power for something. So it was almost didn't even happen. You know, it was just all kinds of crazy things around this record. But in hindsight, like I said, it was a very popular record. I myself have like six different variations of this record in my collection, including, and I highly, highly suggest this copy of it for people who are interested in this record. I have a beautiful Mo-Fi pressing of this record. And if you have a decent stereo, I mean, you don't need like a $100,000 stereo. That's all nonsense. If you have a decent stereo with decent speakers and you turn up this vinyl pressing of the record, there are moments where you could actually believe that you're sitting in the symphony hall listening to this. It's really well, you know, mastered and pressed. And it's a great record, you know, and you have to be one of these people though, that's into the kind of story, this whole kind of Jules Verne, you know, exploratory fantasy type story. If you're into that kind of story and you follow it along, you know, in your mind as you go through the music, it's a fantastic record. But it's not for everybody, obviously, but for us 5%ers, we love these sorts of records.
Well, it's certainly another epic, and we've talked previously about the Knights of the Round Table and all that. But yes, this is the other, I suppose, of the huge epic creations. And what he did after leaving Yes in the late 90s there was to come up with this idea of returning to the centre of the earth to have a sequel. And just before we talk about that, I'm interested in this idea of sequels. And the closest that Yes have really ever come to that is Keys to Ascension and Keys to Ascension 2 that we talked about recently. And that's not really a sequel in any kind of way, just in the name. Yeah. So the other people that I think of, and I'm sure you can think of many more, Mark, is someone like Mike Oldfield, and he's done different versions and returning to the same sort of themes in Tubular Bells 2, 3, 4, and then Millennium Bell and all that kind of thing. And he's also done specifically this, hasn't he? He's done to return to Omadon. Yeah. And, you know, he does like to go back and revisit things. But this is not the thing that Yes have wanted to do. They've never wanted to go back and do Close to the Edge 2 or anything like that. So what other examples do you know of, Mark, and how good are any of them when people return to retread or to look again at their classic albums?
Well, see, here's the thing, and this is my theory. I mean, I'm sure maybe other people have the same theory, but what I think of the matter is that it's a very sketchy ground to walk on, this sort of returning to stuff, because the first couple of records I think of is, for example, there's a band called Queensryche who did a very popular album called Operation Mindcrime. Years later, in the 2000s, they did like a, you know, return to Operation Mindcrime thing. Alice Cooper did Welcome to My Nightmare. In the 2000s, he did Return to My Nightmare, you know. The problem with this approach, I think, is that the records that they usually return to were huge records, records that sold really, really well. And we know how this sort of works out. And it's the same thing with movies. When you do a re-return to something like this, rarely does the sequel or the second part or the redoing of it ever compare to the first record or the first version of it. Now, sure, there might be some people in the Yes community who might disagree with that and might say, well, I like Return better than the original. And that's great. I mean, you know, there's no right or wrong answer to it. But I personally think that when you're doing the original record, you're in a certain mindset. It's come to you. It's a fresh idea. You're excited about it. You put all your energy into it. When you do these sort of retread records, it's not a new idea. It's just you trying to get back into that mindset, trying to refine that energy. And a lot of the times you can't find it. And you can't because you're a different person. You've grown. You know, if there's several years in between these records, like sometimes upwards of 10 years, you can't be the same person musically. You know, you've done so many things and so many things have happened. It's just not possible.
Yeah. Well, this one was 20 years in between the original and this one, or more than 20 years, in fact.
Well, yeah, it came out in, I think it was, March 15th, 1999.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, yes, he decided to go back to this then. And I had a look. So, as you probably know, if you've listened to any of these What Do They Do Next recordings that we do from time to time, the first time we have a general chat about it, and then the second week we look into the music in detail and listen to it and so on. Now, of course, this is an album that you know, Mark, but once again, it'll be a first time for me, Return to the Center of the Earth. So that's I'm looking forward to that once again. But and when I was having a look at some of the details of this record, one thing that leapt out at me was the fact that this is on EMI Classics. Now, Rick Wakeman, I know, has been on quite a few different labels and so on, but there is a story behind why he's on EMI Classics here, and I think it's down to a chap who many Yes fans know, a guy called Nick Cachapo, and I hope that's how you pronounce your surname, Nick, who seemed to intervene at one stage in the story with a friend of his who worked for EMI and was even, you know, high up in EMI, and they thought that because of the forces, which we'll talk about in a second, that Rick wanted to be on this record, it would perhaps sit best with EMI Classics. And in fact, that's where it ended up. So, gosh, I can't think of any other prog album or Yes album or anything like that, which is on a classical label like this. I mean, that's quite surprising, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is definitely a oddity in the discography of this person, Rick Wakeman. But if you think about it, though, I'm surprised, thinking about it in more detail, that he hasn't had more records put on this label. Mm. Because like you said, it is a classically based label. There's a lot of classical instrumentation on Journey, and that sort of thing is on many other records too. And, you know, King Arthur, there's tons of symphony orchestra stuff on there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you do more of a detailed look at his discography, there's others that have just as much symphony orchestra stuff on it as well. And why not put it on a classical label? If that's their speciality, then why not do it?
Mm, absolutely. Well, it was a bit of a tortuous story, I understand, in terms of getting the finance for this record, but they came up with an absolutely stellar cast in the end, and I understand that it cost £2 million to produce, which is not surprising when you think about what's on it and who's on it. So he had the London Symphony Orchestra, the whole lot, the English Chamber Choir, a whole lot of them, Patrick Stewart, international megastar that he is now, and he was pretty hot in those days as well, and guest performances from some of Rick's old pals, Trevor Rabin, Ozzy Osbourne, and Bonnie Tyler, the amazing female Welsh rock singer that she is. And not only the people who were playing and singing on it, but Roger Dean did the artwork, Martin Dean, Roger's brother, did the booklet. So, you know, he really pushed the boat out here. And I think this must have been, I mean, in the end, not sure if he was happy with it, but at the time he must have been very happy, because this is very much what he was looking for the first time round, wasn't it? The not only the technology, but also the forces that he wanted. And this is a studio recording, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is definitely more in line of what his original vision was. And of course, when you're doing a record like Journey the first time around, like I said, it's a new idea. You haven't done something like this before, so you're not prepared fully of what it's going to require to do it. So I think he's learned a lot in between those 20-plus years of the previous record. And, you know, I think this time he really did a great job on getting this done, because, like you said, this was not a cheap record to make. You know, $2 million for an album is nothing to sneeze at. And if you think about it, it even says somewhere, I remember reading that he even chipped in $100,000 of his own money into it as well.
So
that's a considerable amount of money. And the recording was done in 6 different studios, right? So they didn't spare any expense in getting the right surroundings for what they wanted. You know, I mean, getting Ozzy on there was probably a big thing. Bonnie Tyler appears on this as well. Justin Hayward's on here singing Still Waters Run Deep on here. So there's a lot of people within the progressive rock community that, you know, kind of boosted the stature of this record being on there. And of course, you know, having Patrick Stewart being the narrator, I think that was a fantastic idea, you know. You know, and the funny thing is that when you hear those kind of voices on there, it just attracts other people as well. I mean, believe it or not, I would be willing to bet, not a large amount of money, but a little bit of money, on the fact that, you know, when people heard that Patrick Stewart was going to narrate this album, there might have even been a small amount of Star Trek people who might have bought this record purely on that matter.
Yeah, well, this is around the time that Next Generation stuff was all around, wasn't it? So he was very much in the public consciousness.
And yes, I believe so.
I have a tiny little science fiction connection of my own to Patrick Stewart. And there are various others, but I've seen him live in Stratford here where I live on stage in Shakespeare and so on. But in fact, when I first saw Star Wars, when it was released in 1977, I saw it at the Royal Leamington Spa Picture House. I can't remember what the place was called in those days. It was at the cinema. And mm-hmm. and Patrick Stewart tells a story that he indeed also saw Star Wars for the first time ever at that same cinema. So just think, I might have been sitting in the same cinema as Patrick Stewart watching Star Wars, which ignited his passion for science fiction, and he went on to star in Star Trek. So, you know, perhaps had a some small part in his future career. Who knows?
Yes.
But anyway,
you could have been sitting right beside him.
I could have been. And on the other side was my mother, snoring her head off. She fell asleep during the film.
That good, anyway, huh?
Yeah, that good. So anyway, back to the story that we're talking about this week. Yes, so Rick really decided to push the boat out in terms of the forces he employed and getting Patrick Stewart to do the narration and so on. And he also wrote a new story. He wrote all the music, he did the production, he did all the arrangement for the orchestra and choir. And yes, he wrote a new story based on the original Jules Verne story about three unnamed travellers, apparently, who attempt to follow the original route that 200 years previously had been taken to go to the centre of the Earth. So a typically small-scale story by mm-hmm. by Rick, but he certainly wanted to do everything himself. And so all the script that was read out by Patrick Stewart, etc., was all written by Rick. So it's very much a Rick production. Now, I had to, sort of half of me thought, you know, that's great, and it's fantastic to see someone using all his talents to put something together. But I did half of me think, at the back of my mind, did he do this because he couldn't afford to hire anyone else? So he ended up doing everything himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. I mean, you know, having, you know, a complete story written by an actual writer, I'm sure it cost a little bit of change to get that done. Yeah. So, you know, and let's face it. We all know Rick. We love Rick. But having money is something that he always had trouble with. I mean, whether it was his numerous divorces where they took pretty much everything, including yeah. his underwear drawer, probably, from him. He's never one to be good with money. So anything that it comes to saving money in this capacity, I think he would, you know, go forward and do it himself. So why not do the story? And I mean, and if you think about it, really, I mean, I'm not saying that it's easy to do this, but, you know, he's already done the first one. He knows basically what the story was, being probably as a child reading all these stories. Mm. He kind of had the idea of what happened in it. And maybe he just thought in his mind for a long time, you know, what would he do if he was to, continue the story or to make a sequel to it? Or, you know, I mean, it was probably jingling around in his head for a little while. So I don't think it was that difficult to think of the story. But the trick is, of course, to write a story that keeps people engaged on potentially a 40-minute record. Now, if you have a double album, that's, you know, 80 minutes, you know. So, and I know this well, having done now book two of my, in the year 3073, and now I'm going to be working on the last part, book three. So I kind of understand the problem. You know, you have to keep the people engaged. So the story has to flow.
Yeah.
And people have to, you know, not get lost halfway through, you know, listening to them, going, where are we here, you know? So I think that he did a good job overall. I think that the record is well done, and I think it really, really helped to have a narrator, even if it wasn't Patrick Stewart, even if it was anybody else, you know, having a narrator there would be a fantastic idea.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting the way he approached it, because I understand from reading around a bit on the internet that he was originally planning to do Around the World in 80 Days instead of going back to Journey. But he scrapped the idea because it was around the time when Richard Branson was doing his hot air balloon circumnavigating the globe. And he thought that people would link it too much to that event. So he sort of gave up on that. And also he apparently came across a newspaper article by Steven Spielberg talking about films and sequels and so on. And that prompted him to go in a different direction, not to go back and use the same characters, but come up with a completely new story based around the ideas of the old one with these people following the original route. But he made it deliberately different, so they go down apparently into the Earth from a different entrance, so they could experience a different and new journey, which I think is a really, really good idea to go back, but not precisely the same way. But just a last word on the forces again. Great to see that Trevor Rabin's first mention on the sleeve notes is as a guest vocalist. I think that's quite funny. So Justin Hayward, Trevor Rabin, Ozzy Osbourne, Katrina, of Katrina and the Waves fame, if you're British or European anyway, mm-hmm. Bonnie Tyler, Tony Mitchell, all guest vocalists. But at least Trevor Rabin does get a chance to play guitar solos on Never Is a Long Time. So yeah, it's good to get at least one of those people doing what they're really famous for, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and Trevor Rabin having the connection to Yes obviously will solidify, you know, more Yes people to come and check it out as well. And I mean, you know, Ozzy Osbourne, whether you love him or hate him, he is obviously a very strong name in the music world that will bring people as well. And then same with Justin Hayward. He's a great singer.
Yeah.
So these are all, you know, these people weren't just picked willy-nilly from a, you know, pulling a name out of a hat. These were strategically thought out people to bring in for specific reasons on the record. So I think he did a good job.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm very much looking forward to hearing it. Almost 77 minutes, apparently, according to the sleeve notes, almost twice as long as the original. Although I understand that the original in its first incarnation had a running time of 126 minutes, which had to be cut down. And that's...
Wow.
I can see why. And the other thing which I was fascinated by just before we finish is that Wakeman performed this album in its entirety with rock band, orchestra and choir in June 2001 and July 2006. And you know where both of those took place, Mark?
I have no clue.
They both took place in Canada.
Really?
And, yes. And apparently a deluxe box set with live and previously unreleased audio and video material is going to be released this year from those performances in Canada. So
let me guess, in Quebec?
It could be, yes. I don't know exactly, but that sounds about right to me. So it's certainly not the end of his obsession with this story, with this album that he's going to put out this new collection. Of course, we are talking about Rick Wakeman here. He puts out an album every 2 weeks, doesn't he? And, and yeah. A box set with live stuff in it. But but yes, that'll be fascinating to see. So just before we go then, Mark, pick out a few things for me to look out for when I listen to this record. What are some things which stick up in your mind when you think of this return to the center of the earth?
Well, I mean, there's obviously the performances with the guest singers. I mean, obviously Never Is a Long Time with Trevor Rabin is something they should listen to. And actually, track 4, Buried Alive with Ozzy, is a really good song. I mean, don't let the fact that Ozzy Osbourne is singing it, like, you know, turn you off of giving it a chance. I mean, if you go in with, you know, an open mind to it, I think you might actually really enjoy it. The Return Overture is really good. I mean, Rick always has these kind of good overture sections in his albums when he does these kind of things. So that's always very strong as well. There's another interesting kind of part in here, like Time Within Time is really good. You know, I haven't listened to this record for a little while, and I did that kind of, you know, I wouldn't say purposefully, but because I have so many different albums, when I get to this record, sometimes it's a little while in between other listenings.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of almost glad now that I haven't listened to it for a while, because it'll give me a fresh perspective in listening to it. And another thing, just one last thing before we go, that I think is important to mention, is that you mentioned that the album is 76 minutes long. But one thing that people need to realize, though, because people are going to sit there and go, oh my God, 76 minutes, what is it, one song per side? It's going to be like Tales, you know, 27-minute songs. No. This is a lot of 2-minute songs in this. If you look at the track listing in here, there's a whole lot of 1 minute 59, 2 minutes 39 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, another 257. And there are a few like 5-minute songs. Like the ones that have the guests on there, like Trevor Rabin is 519, Ozzy's is 6 minutes long, Bonnie Tyler's is 6 minutes. They give proper respect to the people that are guests, but a lot of these pieces are shorter ones. So it's not like a, you know, thing where you're gonna be like, okay, great, I'm gonna have to go through this section which is 20 minutes long. No, there's a lot of individual chapters,
yeah,
and they're not long. So I think it makes it a lot easier to digest this record.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I'm really looking forward to that. If you've heard this record, if you like this record, have any views on it, then please do add them to the show notes for this week. And just a little teaser for you, I'm hoping to have someone coming on to discuss this record with us next week who is quite involved with the production of it and the reason it exists. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll get that person to speak to next week. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Progressive rock question, the answer is yes.
Just before we go, and for the first time in quite some time, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, and Wayne Hall. And half of those Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, David Pannell, Dave Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, and Fred Barringer. Of course, as always, continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in keeping the lights on here at the new and improved YMP Towers, then please do go to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the button on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. We do hope to be back next week with the second part of our What Did They Do Next about Rick Wakeman. Until then, though, please do get involved via Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.